The George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin murder trial has touched off a national debate about the criminal justice system, stand-your-ground laws, and black-white relations in our society. In fact, these and other topics were discussed recently here in Lexington at a town hall meeting at the Carnegie Center. Well, during a recent editorial meeting in our newsroom, some intriguing questions were raised. What if the shooting took place here in Kentucky? How would the defense and prosecution proceed with their respective cases in a Commonwealth courtroom? And finally, how would the case play out once a Kentucky jury heard all the evidence? Well, to help us in our exercise of what if, I've enlisted the aid of two faculty members at the University of Kentucky's College of Law, Professors Robert Lawson and William Fortune. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could one of you briefly summarize what happened in Florida?
Well, we have, as you know, we have no direct testimony from anyone, really, as to what happened. And so the jury was left to try to recreate whether or not Zimmerman feared for his life. And they concluded that he did and acquitted him. And so without witnesses, it's hard to dispute what the jury resolved in this case. Now, is your question whether or not he had a duty to retreat? Is that your question?
I'm just basically summing up the facts of the case as they were presented in the Florida courtroom.
Well, because there were no direct witnesses, it all came in circumstantially. The various physical findings that were presented to the court about who was on top, where the gun might have been, who might have started the scuffle, and the phone call to 911, and those kinds of things. And the jury just had to sort all that out and decide whether or not they believed beyond a reasonable doubt now that he did not fear for his life when this occurred.
I would add a couple of thoughts to that. This evidence, this case was a case with no eyewitness testimony from anyone except the defendant, and it is significant here that the defendant was able to produce his testimony without ever getting on the witness stand. It all came in through the evidence that was offered by the prosecution. Now, as a result of being able to do that, he was not subjected to any kind of cross-examination. There was no challenge to his credibility in this case. Now, in addition to that, I think, as Bill pointed out, this case was resolved almost from the beginning by the requirement that guilt be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, that's not just a light burden. I mean, that's the heaviest burden of proof that exists in the law. It doesn't require absolute certainty, but it bumps up against it. And so when you've got no eyewitnesses and you have that burden of proof, there is nothing surprising about the outcome in this case to me. I don't see how it could have come out in any other way.
During the trial, there was a lot of talk about the stand your ground law in Florida. But as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Zimmerman's attorneys did not use that in the defense of their client. What does Kentucky's stand your ground law say, and how does it differ from Florida's?
I'm going to let Bob address that because he wrote the penal code originally back in 1974, and he's very familiar with this particular issue on retreat and how we happen to have, as you say, a stand-your-ground law, which has been enacted recently.
Well, back when we reformed our criminal law we enacted it first in 1972 and deferred its date until 1974. That law got prepared by a task force that included some of the best judges and lawyers and representatives of government that existed at the time. Now, after about, we probably worked 4 years on that before we submitted it to the General Assembly. Now, in that law that was submitted to the General Assembly, we had a provision in there requiring retreat. Now, it required retreat only if you were going to use deadly force. As long as you were using non-deadly force to defend yourself, there was no retreat obligation. It was our belief that this, since this law is grounded in necessity, if a person can retreat without using deadly force, he ought to be obligated to do that. Now, here's all that law would have done. First of all, it exempted people who were in their residence. So there was no duty to retreat if you were in your residence. Now, there was no duty to retreat unless you could do it in complete safety. Now, here's the only impact that that law had. Every defendant who makes a defense of self-defense has got to have reasonable grounds for his belief in the need to use that force. Now, that retreat law requires nothing other than a judgment as to whether or not he was reasonable in his belief, taking into account that he could have retreated. You see, so you're mostly talking about a case where, let's say you got the person who is the original aggressor. Let's say he has a stick, and I'm standing there defending myself, and I've got a gun. Okay, now I can walk away from it. That would be the duty to retreat because I can walk away in complete safety. But if I don't walk away, he comes at me with a stick and I kill him, then I'm not going to be able to show that reasonable belief in the need to kill him in order to protect myself. That's all that law did. Now, in 1972 and 74, the Kentucky General Assembly rejected that law and kept an old law that existed on the books for, I don't know, Bill, it's at least 100 years old.
I think so.
That basically says a Kentuckian doesn't have to retreat, and so you can stand your ground. Now, that's basically what the law is. My final thought about it would be this. I don't believe that that situation was presented by the Trayvon Martin case. I don't believe the Trayvon Martin case was a case that presented the duty to retreat problem.
Yeah, and I think Bob was going to add, or could add, the fact that when the current, what we call the Stand Your Ground law, was enacted in this state, it was enacted in the apparent belief that at the time there was a duty to retreat, when that was not the case. In other words, they were enacting a law to meet a problem or meet an issue that did not exist. So they created this statute and created the impression that they'd accomplished something when they didn't. Back in, I guess it was 2006 when that law came on the books.
They thought they were dealing with a problem that wasn't a problem under the law because there was no duty to retreat under Kentucky law. And so they then put on top of that law one that is very complicated and, in our view, confusing as to how you deal with this new law was supposed to deal with a problem was already solved.
Okay. Walk me through, based on your answers here, walk me through then how the incident would play out in Kentucky as applied to the Kentucky law on the books at this time.
Go ahead, Bob.
You're talking about the Trayvon Martin case.
Yes.
Well, here's the way I guess I would look at it. Now, for the most part, there's not much difference between the Florida law and Kentucky law with respect to duty to retreat. Now, as the evidence played out in that case, I don't see the retreat issue arising in that case because you got testimony by the defendant and not presented from the witness stand but presented through videos and other statements. And that basically is testimony in which he is claiming that he was on the ground and this man was pounding on him, pushing his head against the pavement or whatever he was doing. And if you got around to a question of self-defense with the jury, which they did down in Florida, what you would get would be a jury instruction that would require him to have a belief that he was at risk of death or bodily injury and that he believed that he needed to use deadly force to avoid that and that he was reasonable in having those beliefs. Now, that's basically the way that law would have come out. And I think if you take the evidence in that case, whether it's down there or it's up here, and you throw on top of that this very serious burden of proof that exists in a case, I think the outcome is the same.
Gentlemen, do you plan to use this case in instructing future College of Law students here, or is this something that that the media is making more out of than actual law students should pay attention to?
Well, I think it would probably come up in the context of, as Bob said, an example of being able to present your story without having taken the witness stand, which is it would just be an example of that more than a case in which we would talk about it as a significant case on the law itself. Its value, I suppose, for prospective law students is if you can get your client's story out there without having your client take the witness stand, then that's a good thing. I think that's perhaps the moral of this story for future lawyers.
Now, I would say one other thing. Now, Bill Fortune has practiced far more cases than I have, but I practiced criminal law years ago before I became a law professor. And I always felt myself that a defendant who does not take the witness stand has got a most serious problem before the jury, because he's sitting there, and no matter if they do understand that he doesn't have to testify, if he doesn't testify, he's got a big problem. Now, this defendant did not have that problem because this evidence all came in down there personally with him dealing with it, and most importantly to me is he was able to do that without ever being subjected to any cross-examination by the other side. Now, that's a very significant component of this case, in my opinion.
What about now the next move for the Martin family and possible federal prosecution? Either one of you want to tackle that?
Well, for a federal prosecution, the Justice Department would have to be convinced it was racially motivated, which seems to be a high burden for them to carry, and I don't know. Who knows what will happen on that? Now, the family, as you know, can sue. The fact that he was acquitted on the criminal charges does not mean that he is exonerated as far as the civil case is concerned, although I think there is an issue about that under Florida law. It would not occur in Kentucky because I don't believe our stand the ground law attempts to deal with the civil aftermath of matters. As you recall, O.J. Simpson was acquitted and then successfully sued by the family of the victims. So I don't know. It would depend upon how that plays out under Florida law as to whether the so-called stand your ground law somehow or other immunizes him against a civil case. And I don't know the answer to that.
You know, the federal criminal law is very limited in its reach. And so they'd have to be charging him with some kind of special crime. It's going to have to involve some kind of hate element. And it's going to be that offense that gets that would be subject to the prosecution and not murder and that sort of thing. So I don't know what they might do on this. You know, I think all authorities in dealing with this have recognize the difficulty that they confront because of the lack of evidence in the case. Now, we were talking this morning about how long it was before they charged him. This is the kind of offense that prosecutors that I know would jump on top of immediately. But they didn't do that here. They went weeks and months. And I think there was an appreciation that there was a problem here with proving the things that you have to prove in order to get a conviction.
Okay, so what about the question of manslaughter in this trial? Bob, talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think the issue was a little foggy in Florida as to exactly how that would come into play. Now, there are two different ways in which in a murder case like this, manslaughter could become a factor. One of them would be because the defendant did not have the mental state needed for murder conviction. That is, he didn't intend to kill. That is, he didn't want to kill. That's basically what the murder requirement is. But manslaughter can be committed whenever somebody doesn't intend to kill, but they either recklessly or negligently cause some death. And that lowers the penalty down. Now, another way, though, in which manslaughter law can come into play there is where he intends to kill. He makes a claim of self-defense, but his self-defense claim is inadequate because he can't show reasonable grounds for belief in the need to bring about the death of the other person. I believe it was the latter that was involved down in Florida, not the other use of it, but as in all that I saw about it, it seemed to me that there wasn't clarity in the presentation of how those two fit together. It's my belief that the prosecution was never willing to say that there was a killing here without intent. So, I mean, I think they wanted to pursue their murder charge, and so manslaughter came into play with the claim, okay, he intended to kill him, but his defense of self-defense was not good because he didn't have reasonable grounds for his belief.
Do both of you feel that the prosecution did everything that it could to prove its case?
I have no way to know that. I mean, I don't know what they had. I always felt that they were going to confront enormous difficulties in the case no matter what because no eyewitnesses. And they didn't have very much circumstantial evidence that would help them. So, I mean, it wasn't surprising to me that it took them a long time to come to the conclusion that they were going to prosecute this case.
I mean, we've been talking for more than 15 minutes, and only now am I introducing the issue of race. So who wants to tackle that aspect of the case?
Well, in a way, that is how it's been played out in the media. But if you just took the facts of this case and took race out of it and say, okay, we've got two people here and they were involved in this, and as Bob said, here is what was presented, and the jury came to the conclusion that the state had not proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt, you wouldn't think much of it. So what has happened has been the attachment to the fact that this was a young African-American man and a white defendant, and has attached a great deal of significance to that. And I frankly think that's unfortunate. I don't think that this is a case in which you can look at it objectively and say that race was the motivated George Zimmerman to do what he did. I just don't think it's there. There was no, in my mind, no showing of that. And so to the extent that it has been portrayed in the media as a racial matter, I think that's unfortunate.
I agree with that. In that sense, it sort of looks a little bit like the O.J. Simpson case. You know, in that case, you had, I think, a mostly black jury acquitted him. And so it sort of got portrayed the same way. As I look at this case right here, as far as the law is concerned, leaving that out of it, it looks to me like the law worked the way we expect it to work in this case. That is, we've got very severe proof obligations in the criminal law, and we do that because we value freedom, and we want to tilt strongly against conviction and incarceration. And we do that by using a very high standard of proof. And so as I look at the case, I mean, it looks to me like the law played out the way we would want it to play out. Now, it's unfortunate that you got a young man who was killed in the process, but that's kind of always the case when you get a result like you got in this case.
Did the prosecution err in making this a racial issue?
I don't know that they did. Now, if they did, where did they do it? Did they do it at the outset by saying the defendant shouldn't have gotten out of his car to approach this young man? Is that where it started? See, I don't, I mean, I didn't, I watched a lot of what was on TV of the case, not all of it, but I did not see them portraying it as a case where this was a racial killing.
That only happened in the media and in their coverage of the trial. Is that your argument?
Well, it's sort of that way in the end. Now, you know, I'm sure some people can look at it differently. And I don't think, I mean, if you look at, if you go back to that event, that he gets out of the car and he approaches this young man, and I guess he'd say, well, that was the cause of the event and ultimately the cause of the death. Now, there wasn't anything illegal about what he did there. If that was illegal, then he might have had a problem with his defense of self-defense, because the defense of self-defense assumes that the defendant is acting legally. Now, I don't know exactly what his job was, what his role was, but I didn't see any indication that what he did in approaching the young man was a violation of any law.
I don't have anything to add.
We have just enough time for what I would call closing statements, closing arguments. So who wants to go first on that?
I don't think we have anything really to add to what we've said. I think that it's useful for folks who have young teenage boys. I think it's useful for them to take this as an object lesson about how their children, white or black for that matter, might appear to someone, and that for whatever reason, a hooded individual appears to a lot of people to be dangerous or to be up to no good. And it of course, obviously, doesn't make a great deal of sense, but I think parents should take this case as a caution for the way in which their children, their teenagers, dress and act around others, because they don't want to have their children give a front to someone and cause something like this, start some kind of a confrontation which results in a tragedy like this.
Well, I don't think I would have anything to add except to make just a comment or two about the existing Kentucky law, which is what you ask about at the outset. Neither one of us know exactly how that law would be applied. It's got some provisions in it that could change the way in which self-defense criminal cases are prosecuted in Kentucky. It's got a concept called presumption. And when they enacted the law, they put at the very outset a presumption that if somebody kills another in their home, they are presumed to reasonably believe that there was a need to do that. Now, exactly what that means, we're not sure of, because under ordinary circumstances, before a defendant can get a jury instruction on self-defense, he's got to produce some evidence supporting his position. Now, it's conceivable that this presumption could be construed to eliminate that need, so he doesn't have to produce any evidence, and he can get the jury instruction on self-defense. So it's just really hard to know how the Kentucky Supreme Court will deal with this when they confront the problem. But ultimately, I believe they will have to confront the problem.
I guess a question that comes to my mind immediately, because you just kind of opened the door to that, this is a complicated law, as you say. How is a jury supposed to, a jury of the defendant or the person's peers who may not have a lot of background on law itself, how are they, aren't they sort of more or less hamstrung because of their lack of knowledge of the law?
I don't think the problem is going to be with the jury. I think the problem is going to be with courts. You know, courts have got to frame the jury instructions, and the jury instructions are fairly basic. Now, I don't mean to suggest that the decision is not a hard one, because you give them jury instructions that says you got to find that he reasonably believed in the need to protect himself. That's a hard that's a hard judgment that has to be made. But the jury instructions are not that complicated. So I think the big problem here is with how the trial judge goes about formulating the instructions and what the Supreme Court ultimately says about that.
All right, gentlemen, our time is up for today. I appreciate you both sitting here answering my questions. I probably didn't get to a few that I'll think of later, but obviously this is a situation that we wanted to put in front of our listeners and maybe get their feedback on this conversation. And we thank you both for your time today. Bob Lawson and Bill Fortune, University of Kentucky professors at the College of Law. We thank you for sitting in and participating in our game of What If today.
Okay.
Thank you.
You.